The venture capital firm Benchmark has long sat in an enviable spot in the startup world. Its early bets on eBay, Twitter, Snap, and Uber helped cement its reputation as a savvy investor with a deliberate, slow but steady approach to deal making. If you were an early stage startup, having Benchmark on your investor roster was a fantastic signal that you were legit. But are times changing? There are new kids on the venture block, like solo venture capitalists and hedge funds, that represent growing competition to nab stakes in these young hot startups. Benchmark's own investors have questioned whether the firm needs to adapt, and it could miss out on this latest startup wave. This is The 411. I'm Corey Weinberg. On this episode, I'll speak to my colleague Berber Jin, who recently published a profile on Benchmark. He dug into the question of whether Benchmark can maintain its influence in a changing era of venture capital. Then, it was a really busy week for antitrust news. A federal judge rejected a lawsuit that the Federal Trade Commission had brought against Facebook. Lawmakers made more noise about antitrust bills. And Amazon called on the new top antitrust enforcer, Lina Khan, to recuse herself for any cases brought against them. The man at the information covering all that is Joshua Sisko, and we'll talk antitrust in the second part of the episode. You might have heard that venture capital is changing. There's a lot more dollars out there, there's new firms, new faces, deals are closing rapidly, and it's all reshaping the industry. We talked on this podcast before about firms like Tiger Global and Andreessen Horowitz. Now we'll discuss another well-known name, Benchmark. The information's Berber Jin just wrote an in-depth story about what this moment in venture capital might mean for Benchmark, and he joins me now. Hey, Berber.
Hi, Corey.
So you could have focused on a lot of different firms to dive into, but you spent a bunch of time recently digging into Benchmark. Why did you choose that firm?
Yeah, Benchmark obviously is one of the most prestigious early stage venture firms in Silicon Valley. And I was interested by them because they're sort of emblematic of a more traditional, time-worn style of venture investing where a fund is focused on a particular stage, in this case, Series A for Benchmark, and the partnership is small. And so you can sort of contrast Benchmark with an Andreessen Horowitz that sort of has a really big marketing and recruiting teams and a really big set of investors. And the reason why I think it's interesting to look at Benchmark now is because the venture market has shifted in a way that's prioritizing investors that are move really fast on deals and also are more generous on the amount of ownership they want for companies. And sort of in the last 5 years adapted by, you know, raising larger funds, going international. And Benchmark has sort of kept its size small. They haven't raised funds greater than $500 million since the early 2000s. And yeah, so it's interesting to look at the firm and sort of that model more generally, how viable it remains in today's investing environment.
Right. It's an outlier. We like to look at outliers. You obviously wrote in the story that this current moment that you described in VC, where it is so fast moving, firms are raising larger funds, all of this might be stressing Benchmark's model a little bit. Could you talk a little bit about the evidence that you found for that?
Yeah, definitely. I think there are a few sort of deals that I mentioned in the article that sort of highlight the change dynamics at play. The first is a deal with WorkOS, which is a sort of enterprise software company. They had a really competitive Series A round last April where Benchmark was competing with Lackey Groom, who is a solo venture capitalist. And what's interesting about that round is it's WorkOS's founder, Michael Grinnick, wanted to take structure the round a little bit differently and have the lead investor take up less ownership than, you know, what one could expect maybe and would be the norm 3 or 4 years ago. Benchmark, in the example of that deal, wanted to take at least a 20% stake, whereas Lackey Groom was a lot more flexible than that. And as a result, you know, Michael Grinnick was able to structure the round differently, bring in different types of investors. And I think that deal is one example of how today's venture environment at the early stage, founders have a lot more options in terms of financing than they once did, you know, 3 or 4 years ago. It's not to say Benchmark isn't competitive anymore. It still is extremely competitive. But there are a few instances of deals similar to WorkOS where sort of the structure in which Benchmark does deals, particularly around ownership and wanting to buy up at least 20% of a company, just no longer is as convincing to founders as it once was.
Right. And one way that other venture firms, such as Andreessen Horowitz and Sequoia, have been able to get larger stakes in their portfolio companies is by raising these larger growth stage funds where they can end up owning a larger percentage of startups. Even if they get a fairly small slice in the beginning, they can kind of keep adding on. And both of those firms have been doing that a lot lately, and it's paid dividends. As you mentioned, Benchmark has held its ground. It hasn't really raised these larger growth funds. Why is that?
You know, that's a really good question, Corey. I think you can actually look to Benchmark's history. It's really interesting. Benchmark is actually one of the first Silicon Valley firms to try and expand internationally and raise really large funds. They raised a big fund dedicated to Europe in 2000, and they raised an Israel fund in 2001. And the firm sort of expanded too quickly. It was hard for them to replicate the sort of egalitarian partnership model they have internationally. And it all came crashing down. The European fund spun out into a separate firm called Baldrigin Capital. They stopped raising Israel funds in 2010. And I think that pass is part of the hesitancy that the firm has today to raise bigger funds. Obviously, their returns are still extremely strong. The 2018 fund, I reported in the article that it's already returned over 4 times. Even though that fund is still very early, it's still a very, very strong number.
4 times the money that investors had put into it?
Exactly. And so they have a strong track record, but it's undeniably the case that their competitors, like Andreessen and Sequoia, as you mentioned, have adapted by raising larger funds. And, you know, I think as the private market has sort of ballooned in size in the last few years, and as private companies stay private for longer than they have before, just on a pure numerical and mathematical basis, it's just a lot easier to get venture-level returns if you have the option to double down on early winners or invest, you know, at a Series C or D. You know, if you look at Stripe, for example, that company stayed private for over 10 years. It's valued at $95 billion. If you invested, at one of their growth stage rounds 2 or 3 years ago, you're looking at really, really good returns today.
I think one of the most interesting pieces of your story was the fact that you really got into the nitty gritty of kind of how this firm operates. You know, you cover venture capital and capital markets in general. What stuck out to you from what you learned about how this firm actually makes decisions and how it's structured?
Yeah, it's a sort of very classic partnership model. I think in the same way Andreessen inspired a lot of firms to build out their sort of services they offer to founders in the past, you know, few years, Benchmark really inspired a lot of firms to adopt a very sort of traditional partnership model that centers decisions they make on potential investments based off the consensus of the firm. And so at least prior to the pandemic, Benchmark's partner meetings on Mondays, the firm's partners would, you know, spend sometimes hours debating investments that one of the partners wanted to make. And at the end of those deliberations, they have this voting process where the partner championing the deal will split up a piece of paper into however many, into parts of how many partners are there. And they write a number from 1 to 10. And if the number is below 5, that means one of the partners doesn't think the deal should go through. The partner who's leading the deal can still make the investment, but the idea culturally is for the firm to sort of operate as a team and to make sure that an investor who's passionate on a deal doesn't have any blind spots when he's approaching or he or she is approaching a particular investment. And I think that is that sort of model has been really inspiring to lots of venture firms. But today, it's a lot less common than before because you have these sort of hedge funds and even more traditional venture firms like Andreessen that are moving extremely quickly on deals, partners oftentimes are able to act on their own, make a decision on the spot. And so it's an open question whether, you know, that model is better or worse than what Benchmark espouses, but the market is definitely rewarding people who move really fast today. Venture is always adapting, and there are always these conversations about which particular investing model works better or for worse. I personally think that Benchmark will continue to stay extremely competitive. They're still a premier Series A firm, and if you just look at the track record of their partners, it really is phenomenal. And I think the firm will continue to do well. I do think, however, it's a lot more difficult for Benchmark to be Benchmark today than maybe a few years ago, just because of, you know, how drastically the market evolved.
Right. Thanks so much for coming on the show. I appreciate your reporting and your insights.
Great. Thanks, Corey.
So it was a really busy week of antitrust news, probably highlighted by the fact that a federal judge rejected a lawsuit that the Federal Trade Commission had brought against Facebook. We're going to start there. I have Josh Sisco, information antitrust reporting extraordinaire, here with me. Josh, let's start with this FTC news. It was kind of an embarrassment for the FTC to have this happen, but let's start with kind of the basics. Why was the FTC suing Facebook in federal court to begin with? What was that odds here?
So late last year, the FTC sued Facebook along with a coalition of nearly every state attorney general in the country. I think there was just a handful that didn't participate in a parallel suit, also in federal court, trying to unwind Instagram and WhatsApp, the acquisitions from 2012 and 2014, as well as to stop Facebook from discriminating against competing developers with some important software development tools. So they were trying to curtail Facebook's market power, and they brought these landmark antitrust cases.
Okay. And the ruling against the FTC was by a U.S. district judge who was a Barack Obama appointee. What did the judge say in his ruling?
So it was a pretty sweeping ruling against the FTC with a few important caveats. I guess I should say against the FTC and the states. It was a bit more sweeping against the states. But the judge in the FTC case said that the FTC had not offered enough detail about Facebook's market power in what the FTC was saying is the personal social networking market. And so that's kind of a fancy way for saying social media. And in its lawsuit, the FTC, its only real allegation of Facebook's market power was that it controls at least 60% of this market. But they didn't say what the actual number was, and they didn't offer any sort of metrics or details describing the level of control or by what measure they're determining that Facebook has this market power.
Right. So the judge basically says this as well as a flimsy case, not really enough evidence here. There are obviously other avenues that antitrust hawks are using, in particular in Congress. Lawmakers used the ruling this week to essentially bolster the idea that legislative antitrust reform is needed in the future. And there are a bunch of bills wading through Congress on this topic. How could antitrust reform bills that are taking, you know, obviously a more legislative route, could that prevent a similar loss in court in the future? How are these two kind of playing against each other?
So according to the bills, as they're currently written, they would have, my understanding is would eliminate this type of ruling from the judge. And it's important to note that the judge didn't toss the FTC's case permanently. He's going to let them try again in the next 30 days to sort of add more detail about how Facebook controls the market. He kind of gave them a roadmap of what he needs to see. For example, he said that the FTC can't use a metric such as how much time people spend on Facebook's site as a way of determining like their percentage of the market. But he is letting them try again. But these bills would sort of eliminate the need to make that calculation. Like the bills would assume Facebook and a handful of others, Google, Apple, Amazon and most likely Microsoft, they would assume those companies to have market power. And so you wouldn't need to do this sort of economic exercise in order to make that determination.
Gotcha. And you are not necessarily a political reporter, but read the tea leaves a little bit for us here. Do any of these bills actually have a shot at passing the House and the Senate?
I think they have more of a shot than they ever would have before, but I think that there's some serious headwinds. I mean, not all the Democrats are aligned. They are bipartisan. They were co-sponsored by Democrats and Republicans, but not all the Democrats support them. Not all the Republicans support them. Senior Democratic leadership in the last couple of days came out and said, Democratic leadership in the House came out and said that they're not ready to go to a debate on the full floor of the House. So I think that it's going to take a little while. And plus, they have to be reconciled with the Senate, any companion bills in the Senate. So the process is going to be, it's going to take some time. Again, I am not a congressional reporter, but I just don't see it happening this term. But I could be surprised. But they got a long road ahead of them.
Right. And in the regulatory agencies, this was an inauspicious start for the FTC's new chair, Lina Khan, very famous in antitrust circles, who's been one of the leaders of this movement to curtail the power of Facebook and Amazon and Google. She was appointed FTC chair in June. You've been reporting on some of her staffing appointments in the FTC, that those are important signals to follow. What should we make of them?
Yeah, so I guess first off, it's kind of hard to overstate the impact of having Lina Khan as chair of the agency. I think an apt analogy would be it would be sort of like the head of, say, Earth First or some environmental advocacy group being appointed as head of the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency. So it's a really big deal. She is very outspoken, and that appointment has made a lot of people on the left very happy. In terms of her staffing, some of the people who are now leading investigative teams at the agencies were advisors for Commissioner Chopra, and who was a minority commissioner for several years, and now they're in charge. And I think it's a very clear sign that she's trying to sort of shake things up.
Gotcha. You mentioned that Lina Khan's appointment has pleased a lot of people on the left. It definitely has rankled, obviously, the tech companies in her crosshairs. Amazon on Wednesday asked the FTC to recuse Lina Khan in antitrust investigations of the company. Amazon cited Khan's recent work with Congress and her own papers that accused Amazon of violating antitrust law. Is Lina Khan going to have to recuse herself? You described this, I think, in your story as an expected move. Is this just political wrangling, or is she going to actually have to step aside for anything Amazon related?
Well, it's definitely expected that Amazon would do this. I think they've telegraphed this, or at least lobbying groups who work on their behalf have telegraphed this. I kind of doubt that she's going to have to recuse. I mean, the bureaucratic process for recusal, I think, sort of favors her. There would have to be a vote from the other commissioners, and it would likely be a deadlocked vote. And so the way I understand it, that would leave her not having to recuse herself. Also, it's unclear as to whether this violates any sort of ethical guidelines. I mean, there's case law around commissioners, chairs specifically, having to recuse in administrative cases when the chair has previously worked in Congress investigating like the same issues that are now before the agency. It's unclear if that would apply across the board. There's a lot unknown. I don't think that she believes that she needs to recuse. I don't think she would have taken the job had she thought that she would have had to recuse. So I would say that it's an uphill battle at best. For Amazon, but it shows that how much of an impact this is going to have on this is having on these companies.
Right. Well, you have one of the most active beats at the information right now, trying to track all the legal antitrust sort of related maneuvers. What are you watching next? What's on your list of things to be following up on or just to be closely tracking?
Oh, there's so many things. Right now, I mean, what what the FTC does with Amazon, what the DOJ ends up doing or not doing with their investigation of Apple. Both of those are still underway, and it's not clear what will happen. In the maybe more immediate term, what the FTC does as with its merger review of Amazon's MGM Studios acquisition, that's at the FTC as well. And so that will... merger reviews are on a clock, so to speak. So those, because they need to happen much more quickly than these kind of broad, sprawling conduct investigations, which can take years. So we'll have some clarity around the MGM deal sometime later this year. The remaining appointments at the agencies, what, how Lina Khan is going to reshape the FTC. There's a lot out there that we're following.
Awesome. We look forward to more conversations about this. Thanks so much, Josh, for breaking it all down.
Thank you.
That's our show. Thanks so much for listening. Thank you to Keenan Cush for producing today's episode. Have a great weekend, everybody.